Yo. Yo.
Just go ahead and freestyle.
This is Jessa Reed, and you are listening to Soberish.
Oh, you gotta write a verse for that theme song. Yo, this is Jessa Reed, and you'll be listening to Soberish. But you already tuned in, so you're already knowing this. What?
It makes many guests want to do drugs.
Yeah, that's a ketamine song if I ever heard one.
Speaking of ketamine, we're here with Rob Christensen.
Yeah.
Ketamine spokesperson.
Yes, spokesperson.
We did an episode with you of Mormon and the Meth Head, and then I haven't stopped thinking about ketamine since.
That's healthy. Sounds very healthy, yeah.
So I thought you should come here to the addiction podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so good.
I did a shit ton of K back in the day, but I don't feel like I remember it. It's one drug where I can think back to GHB or any other drugs and remember what it was like. The only thing I remember about ketamine was coming out of that K-hole with the secrets to the universe and losing them immediately.
Yeah.
There's a veil or like a hole that you pop back out of, and then you've lost it. And it's like, fuck, now I have to go back.
Yeah. It's if you go that deep, yeah.
Yeah.
But I've taken lessons out that I've kept, you
know,
like if you find, but you never know how much is the right amount. You're just experimenting.
Yeah. We're not recommending that, obviously, but
or
whatever. I love your story so much. We, like I said, we did the Mormon and the Meth Head episode with you, and then I went back and edited it and laughed all over again. Your adventures with using drugs are some of the greatest. We met at Epic's Unprotected Sets.
Yeah.
Taping.
Yeah.
And did anything ever come of that for you?
You know what I got out of that? I learned. I learned not to expect too much. No, but you never know with those things. I've done a bunch of TV tapings. You never know. The one that did the most, though, was This Is Not Happening.
This Is Not Happening. Same here.
Yeah,
that's still delivering. And that was, I just was on YouTube.
Yeah.
I didn't even get on the TV show.
No one cared about when I was on television.
No.
They only cared about the YouTube part.
Yep. It's still getting like 100,000 downloads a month. Well, tell us a little bit about your story.
Related to drugs?
Yeah.
So my dad did a lot of drugs. So I was in AA meetings like when I was like 11 years old.
Just
like my dad had to go to them.
Yeah.
Or now that I'm an adult, I wonder, because he would have us on the weekends. So I don't know if he was like, oh, I got the kids, I need to go to an AA meeting. So they tell their mom I'm going to AA meetings. You know? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But like when you're a kid, you think, oh, my dad's really doing this, trying to stop doing drugs. And then as an adult, you're like, or was he just doing it in front of us? You know, you never know what to expect. But so I was in a bunch of those types of meetings when I was a kid. And then I started doing drugs basically just to have friends.
To be cool. Or?
Yeah, I remember the first time I smoked a cigarette, first time I smoked weed, it was always just to be in the circle, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you not cool before drugs were an option?
Yeah, I didn't find the outlet.
You're so cool.
Yeah, but so it was always through sports, right?
Yeah.
And it was just like, both of my younger brothers are really good at sports. Like, one played minor league baseball, the other one was the captain of his baseball team. I'm the oldest, but I didn't have that, like, natural talent. Or maybe when I was, like, really, really young, I didn't play catch enough, but they did. So
yeah.
I didn't have the foundation. So I had to, like, but sports was the only outlet I was given. So it was like, all right, we're all going to go play baseball. We're going to do baseball games on the weekend. We're going to do baseball lessons during the week. So if you're not doing that, sit at home. And so I just started doing that. And then I ended up getting decent just by like playing a mental game of like, all right, what are my strengths? All right, I can hit pretty well. So I got really good at hitting, played first base where I didn't get a lot of action. I just had to catch the ball a lot.
Yeah.
But it wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. If there was other outlets for me, you know?
Yeah, drugs. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, well, like, that drug, it ended up being drugs, but there was no other, I couldn't find another outlet. And so it was like, I don't want to play sports anymore. Who's left? And then you look around and it's like, oh, I'm not going to do the theater thing because, yeah. you know, people will call me gay. It's the 80s. And so the drug kids. Oh, so they're the cool, who's the cool people that don't do sports? All right, there they are.
Yeah. I tried sports. I'm just bad. Just bad. Lazy also, and then didn't pass any classes. So you had to like pass classes to be allowed to participate in sports. And so I was EP on a softball.
What is EP?
Extra player.
So they made up a position for
Wait,
you.
Wait, is that not a real
to
thing?
To try to keep you off drugs.
To no avail.
Yeah.
Is that not a real thing? Is that
I never heard.
I swear
extra
to fuck,
player.
I was the EP.
I never.
And so,
I was once during an award ceremony. I got most improved player of the whole league. Of the whole league, meaning that I sucked so much last year, they gave me an award.
Aw, that's sweet though.
Yeah.
Maybe you just were the most.
Well, I did.
It
I did
like
it on
you were
purpose.
Strategizing.
Yeah. Yeah
and
I had no choice. But it's like this is the world I live in, and I have to be get good at this, or else I'm nobody. You know.
And then you peaked and switched.
Yeah. Oh, I chose. I just knew I was lying to myself.
Yeah.
And then I was always got really into skateboarding and really into rollerblading, which are like sort of solo sports, sort of not barely sports, you know?
Yeah.
And then also those people who do those sort of things, they smoke a lot of weed.
Yeah.
They drink on the weekends and shit. That was more my speed.
How old were you the first time you drank?
Oh, man. I think it was the summer going into high school. So I'm a September birthday, so I was probably 12.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
I didn't get drunk. I was just drinking. I was so scared to drink, and I like took half a Zima and poured it out and then filled half up with water, so I drank a watered-down Zima. And I milked it the
Is that an oxymoron?
Whole night. I milked it the whole night, so I didn't get drunk. And then I was so nervous about smelling like alcohol, I got so much gum, and I was chewing gum and rubbing gum on my hands and everything. And then I came home, and my dad was like, were you drinking? I was like, no, why? He's like, because you don't chew gum. I've never seen you chew Big Red once in your fucking life.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so that, and I was super scared to do it. I was only doing it to hang out. I didn't even have an interest in drinking. I was just doing it to be cool.
I imagine drinking a Zima to seem cool.
Yeah, I was not good at it. I didn't say I was achieving being cool. I said I was trying to attempt it. Yeah.
I love 12-year-old logic to rub gum.
Yeah.
You're just walking.
I chew it a little and then rub it on my hands. Now I got sticky hands.
There's no soap.
Just in case someone's going to smell my hands, which has also never happened before. But today's
also,
the day.
Also, why would it be on your hands from when you dumped it into the sink?
Yeah. It was in a bottle the whole time. Makes no sense. Yeah. Prepared.
Did you keep drinking after that or take a break?
Yeah, there was like long spaces in between, and I probably didn't like really drink to have fun until like 15 or 16, probably 3 years later. Yeah.
First time I drank was at a skating rink. I do not recommend.
Yeah.
It is not. I think I drank several times before that. We actually cleaned out my parents' liquor bottles. And I would try to get drunk, but I just, like, didn't understand how much it takes to get drunk or something. Because they had awful, like, raspberry liqueur.
Horrible.
Just awful shit. And so I would drink a little bit of it and wouldn't get drunk because it's just syrup. And then the first time I actually drank, I drank way too much Cisco. Do you remember Cisco?
Oh, I have Cisco nights, yeah. Cisco would do it to you.
Oof.
Tastes too good.
Oof.
Yeah.
It tastes like something that you should be able to drink out of a sports bottle, but it is not.
Smashed, yeah.
We used to steal nitrane.
I never had that.
Nitrane's like bum wine that they sold at the grocery store and Boone's Farm.
I know Boone's Farm. We did a lot of St. Ides and then St. Ides Special Brew, which was flavored. Do you know about that?
No.
So St. Ides Special Brew was like mango malt liquor or pineapple malt liquor. We were kids, so we're like, yeah.
And who else is that for? Man,
who's it for? Who is it for?
Oh,
horrible.
We drank so many 40s because I wanted to be Ice Cube.
Oh,
that's all I wanted was to be Ice Cube.
Me
we
too.
Would just get drunk, smoke Newports, and watch Boys in the Hood.
I smoke Newports.
And then get a dent puller and go out and try to pull ignitions out of cars.
What? That's some country shit. I don't know nothing about that. We would get drunk and write graffiti. That's what we would do.
We were about stealing rims. Yeah. We heard that's what the cool kids were doing.
Sure. Straight into felonies.
Who, me?
Both of us, but I guess back then, graffiti's a felony now, but it was a misdemeanor when I was a kid.
Yeah. Is it a felony now?
It is a felony now, but they only did that to have power when they're charging people because they used to have, at least I can only speak on New York, right? So in New York, graffiti was wild. It was everything was covered, including the trains, and it was a misdemeanor, so they couldn't get anyone to snitch. Because kids would come in and know they're just facing community service and be like, fuck you, give me community service, and walk out. They couldn't even hold them. Or you have to write them tickets and shit. Giuliani took office, and he was like, all right, now we're going to make it a felony, but it's not to put kids in jail. We make it a felony because now when a 15-year-old's facing a felony, he tells us who his other friends he's writing graffiti with. We take down the whole crew. We find out the guy we really want, because we don't want this guy. We want the 32-year-old who's been bombing the city for 10 years. And so they started to take graffiti out that way.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's insane.
It worked. I mean, it sucked to be on my end of it, but for the cops, I guess the ploy worked, yeah.
I do know someone who got a felony from putting a sticker on a phone booth or carving his name. Did I tell this story before? He carved his name on a phone booth. He used to put stickers on everything. Maybe that's because he was already a felon from carving his name on a phone booth. But a cop walked up while he was carving his name on a phone booth when he was 18 years old.
Damn.
And now he has a permanent felony on his record as a result. Also, phone booths don't exist.
They don't exist. He got a felony for vandalizing something that doesn't fucking exist anymore.
Yeah, it's insane. Wow. I thought felonies were like if you... I mean, I understand what felonies are, but the entire justice system drives me insane. It's like, oh, God, let's make sure that we get all of the phone booth vandals off the streets.
And it's so much about what the cop, if the cop hates graffiti artists, you're in trouble.
Yep.
Or if the cop is like really pissed off that day, you're in trouble.
Yep. Yep. If he had a bad day.
Yeah.
So when did you become a felon?
I'm still not a felon. I'm still have never been convicted of a felony.
What happened after you started drinking at 15?
So, yeah, and then, like, probably that same year, I smoked weed for the first time out of a Honey Bear bong. And then it was my first time, but I told everyone I had smoked weed before, like, no big deal. And it was just kind of like, I was just doing that to, like, hang out with girls, basically. It was just like, I just want to be, like, hanging out. I don't know what to do with myself. I want to be around girls, and this is where they're at. So I was just doing it that way. And I was, like, really pushing back on the drugs for the most part. Like, I sniffed one bump of coke and I was like, oh, I'll never do that again. I was just like, didn't want to do it.
Did you like the weed?
I smoke weed pretty, heavily. I was a pothead. And then I like started selling it. I was just like, my biggest flaw my whole childhood is like, I was a driven person with nowhere to put it. So when I started smoking weed, it was not 2 years later, I was selling weed.
Right.
And it wasn't just me, but I have my best friend, Gary, who I talk about in the ketamine story on This Is Not Happening, still my best friend to this day. Me and him just started selling weed together because we were driven, smart kids with no outlet. So now we have a weed business. And so now we become worse criminals. And so now someone wants to rob us. And so we got to fight. And so this, so like you're everything steps up, you know? So it's like if someone wants to rob you, now I'm not just a drug dealer. Now I'm a guy who has to do violence, right? Assault.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's like, so now they want to come back at you, so now you got to get a gun. Now, I didn't want to go down this road. I didn't let it get that far, but I was walking that path, and I just kind of knew it wasn't for me. I got really into, like, the rave scene, though, because we were selling weed, and also, before we jump to there, I got caught smoking weed. My mom found a baggie in my bathroom because it was windy out, so I went into my bathroom in my house to roll a blunt because it was too windy outside, and I forgot the baggie on the ground. And they put me into outpatient rehab. Yeah. So 15 years old, smoking weed for 3 months, and I did like 6 months in outpatient rehab with dudes that were getting out of jail, just like straight neck tattoos, real like mafia guys, real Italian mafia guys, Latin Kings, Scarface motherfuckers. I was sitting there just like, I had long blonde hair down to my shoulders, just terrified, just like a fucking 120-pound 15-year-old.
Were your parents just squares?
Nah, man. My dad was the opposite. My dad was a super drug addict. And so he got cleaned up through the 12 steps. that worked for him. So he's like, oh, this is the way it happens. This is the way you do it. And then also sometimes when people get off drugs, they think people who do drugs are drug addicts no matter what.
Yeah.
Because they never had a situation where they could just do drugs like a normal guy and then stop and say that's enough and then go to work on Monday. Since they could never do that, they don't think anyone can do that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So he was like, oh, if he's smoking weed, he must be a drug addict. And then my mom was just like, you know, fucking housewife, like, oh, that's how I would describe it.
So they're still together at this point?
No. No, at this point, they're separated.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they teamed up to send you to outpatient.
Yeah. The one thing that could bring them together was making sure I was a drug addict.
Did that make you do more drugs? Like, did it introduce you to things?
It made me super numb. First, I was numb to the whole system because I was 11 years old. I was sitting through these AA and NA meetings, and my dad would take me there on, like, they do shares. They do sharing and shit like that. So I'd go watch people share, and I'd hear their fucking worst stories, and it was too young. You'd think it did not scare me. It made me comfortable around that element.
Yeah.
You know?
Fuck, that's a really good point.
Yeah. It made me comfortable.
There was... Because were you around for your dad's active addiction?
Yeah, but I was too young. I was, like, pretty well hidden from me. But it was, like, I knew my parents were fighting all the time. And I knew I'd get, like, walks to the park with my dad where he'd be like, yeah, mom's mad at me for gambling. And I was like, and I think in my little 9-year-old head, I'd think, gambling's the best lie you could come up with? Like, like I didn't know what he was really getting yelled at for, what they were really fighting about. But I know it must be bad if gambling is the cover, if that's the cover story.
My mom did a lot of drugs around me. I remember when I was 6, she was selling coke, and we had like a Jack and Jill bathroom, and I just was too familiar with all of it. Yeah. There was a bong, a weed bong under the table. I took my first like fake bong hit at 6. You know, they didn't hold down the carb or anything, so they like light it. The flame wasn't going to do it, but I understood all of that stuff. And then... this Jack and Jill bathroom was open, so I went in from my bedroom and to go to the bathroom, and as I was pulling her door closed, I went, you know, just like put my finger up against my nose and pretended to do a line, just like letting the guy know, hey, I'm hip, you know?
Oh, man.
And the guy freaked out on my mom and left. And I think my mom's logic was just like, she didn't want to be a liar. You know, she wanted to be honest. And I kind of carried myself like a 40-year-old. Like I was a very grown-up kid.
Yeah.
And so I understood a lot about it. And I didn't plan on going down that road. But when I started doing meth, I was just with this pocket of people who the rave got away from. So the people who just start doing meth at the end of the ecstasy high and then they end up addicted to meth.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of a crew of like 20 people from that. And I was so much better at tweaking immediately than everyone else. I was so much better living in that chaos because they all came from good homes or, you know, like they all came from not drug addicted parents. And they had this adjustment period that I didn't have because I was desensitized to it. So I wasn't freaking out that half of my tooth just fell out. I wasn't freaking out that the cops just came and kicked down the door because I'd been in a raid before, you know. So it's funny that taking you'd already heard all this stuff in the meetings and it didn't scare you when you went back.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So then we skip forward. I do that 6 months of outpatient. I'm smoking weed the whole time.
Oh, they don't drug test you?
I guess they didn't drug test me. I guess my parents just wanted me to do the intellectual side of it. I don't know. There's all these scare tactics that did not work. It was just like, I'm getting more and more comfortable in this world. And then me and Gary and a few other dudes were selling weed, and like we worked up from an ounce to a quarter pound, from a quarter pound to a pound, and then we fucking had a fucking stack of $1,000. So like... what is this now? It's probably like 96, 94, 94, 95, 96. $1,000 was worth a little more then.
Yeah.
Especially to a 16, 17-year-old. We thought we were Scarface. You know what I'm saying? We had this G, and then we were just thinking, like, you know, the weed, this is slow money. It took us too long to flip up like this. And it's dangerous, right? Because so selling other drugs is the same amount of danger as weed at that time. Weed was still very illegal. You go to jail, you still get robbed, you still have to do all the violence, you still have to get a gun. So you're like, if everything else is equal, but the money is more, let's sell ecstasy. Because 94 is like,
oh my God,
rave scene, New York City, killing it. And so we decided to go get 100 hits of ecstasy for $1,000, $10 a pill. It was all of our money, and we got beat. We got sold 100 fake hits of ecstasy by these dudes in this crew called BTS, which was like the gang that ran the raves in New York. But we couldn't take the loss. We couldn't take the hit. So we're like, fuck it. If we believed it was ecstasy, other people will believe ecstasy. So we took it out of town, and we went to like up to Connecticut and down to Baltimore and shit to other raves. And we sold all of our fake ecstasy and got our money back. And then we started thinking, well, if we don't even need real drugs, now we get to lose the risk of getting arrested for drugs and make the money of, and never once thought we're selling fake drugs to people that are going to come get us. All we saw were dollar signs. So we just started doing that. We started like, we'd have some real drugs, we'd have some fake drugs. Through all that, the drug of choice for me then became ketamine and PCP.
PCP. Yeah, this one blows. I've never met a person that likes PCP before you.
Yeah.
Everyone has like one PCP story and it's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah. So the reason I mentioned BTS who sold us the fake drugs is because as we were doing this in the rave scene, you couldn't just do that because they ran that shit. So we had to get involved with them. And we had played Little League with this kid, Paulie Porkchops. Rest in peace, Paulie Porkchops. He died of a heroin overdose like 10 years after this, the time I'm talking about now. And so we played Little League together. Quick side story. And we were playing Little League, and it was not on purpose, but our team was mostly white, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't on purpose. It was just like, we lived in a white neighborhood. So the team was mostly white. We were playing for a Catholic school or something like that. And so another school came from a Puerto Rican neighborhood, and it was the day of the Puerto Rican Day Parade. So the Puerto Rican Day Parade in New York is a big deal. So they were celebrating. There was music in the dugout. They were they had their flags up. They were waving flags. And so we're beating them pretty good. And I was playing first base, and there was a play to like a ground ball to second base, and they throw the guy out at first, but a guy from third base was running home. So I had to turn real quick. I catch the ball at first, and I had to turn and throw home to throw the dude out. And the Puerto Rican kid was running up the first base line, throws an elbow into me, so I can't get the ball out of my glove. So I have to fumble to get the ball out and recover and throw, and then they score because I can't throw fast enough.
Right.
So I turn around, I'm like, to the ump, I was like, this dude threw an elbow at me. And then the kid says, and what are you going to do about it? And so I turn around and just start throwing punches. I'm just punching his helmet till it falls off. He wore goggles. You know, I guess he had to wear glasses, so he had goggles on. I knocked the goggles off his head. I'm just wailing. And like fucking the benches cleared. And then Paulie came in from the outfield. Paulie Porkchops came in the outfield and held some dude up by his neck with one hand. He was like a big Italian kid. It was a big ass brawl. And then they benched me after that. So
that's a cool intersection of your attempt at sports.
Yeah.
And
yes. So they should have put me in fighting because it was the thing I was doing. It was the sport that I was doing all on my own, you know? And so that's like how I knew Paulie. We at least had this one situation where he knows he was with BTS and he was kind of a drug dealer and he was high enough that, you know, no one would fuck with him. And he knew me from baseball, but also at least I had that one situation where he knew I threw some hands on someone. So
right.
He doesn't think I'm like a bitch, right?
Right.
So we get with Paulie and now we start selling drugs for Paulie, but we're really just selling drugs for ourselves, throwing Paulie a cut to protect us. And then we meet all the BTS kids. And then after a few years of that, we are BTS. So we become part of BTS. And
the rave gang.
But they created us because if they never sold us fake drugs, we would never be in their crew.
Holy shit.
But they made it happen. And they sell most people fake drugs. They never see them again. But we lived in Brooklyn. This crew is Brooklyn Terror Squad. It's from Brooklyn. We were never going to go away. And we couldn't fight them. So we ended up in the thing. And at that time,
is this a movie yet? Or
I mean, I wrote a pilot. Shout out to anyone listening. I wrote a 1-hour pilot called Brooklyn Terror Squad, and it's about the real life events of it's a hit.
Yeah.
So now we're in BTS, and at that time, everyone who was selling drugs, the tough guy drug was PCP. So PCP was what we would smoke and sell to each other, and then ecstasy, real or fake. and like meth real or fake, and then ketamine real or fake, we'd sell to the ravers. And that's how I got into that ketamine and PCP and stuff like that.
All right. So BTS, got it. You're in the gang. That does not explain how you think PCP is a pleasurable experience. You have not justified that.
I don't know, man. We just like to get high on that shit and leave the planet, you know? And then, so PCP, at least when I was smoking it, had stages where, depending on how much you smoke it, you leave the planet. For a minute, you're immobile for like, you know, whatever, the first 15 minutes. And then you start to come back around and you're in this weird, like, bubbly, also kind of sharp phase. that like the world is different, but then and then at last, like, you think you're the fucking man, dude. Like, not so much people hate PCP because they smoke it and they get too high and they're like, I never want to get that high again. They don't smoke it again. But like, if you're trying to sell drugs and be mean, it keeps you nice and mean.
Yeah,
like you talk, like you start slurring your words and shit. You start talking like this and say, I'm all high on PCP, but I haven't smoked for like 3 hours, but I'm still this guy, you know? Like, I'm still, it keeps you mean, you know?
I might have told you a story before, but the first time I ever smoked weed, ever, had ever smoked weed. I think I'd been drunk once in my life. First time I smoked weed, had fucking PCP.
Oh, my God.
And I didn't know, like, because I didn't know anything. I was, like, excited. We got a couple hours away from my parents, and we went. They took us to Philly, and the guy ordered wet off the street corner, but I didn't know that that's what that meant.
Yep.
And then we smoked it, and it's this frustrating, like, the air became tar that you're trying to walk through,
you can't
fucking move, and everything is annoyingly slow motion. And then we got to the house, and I couldn't find the Visine, and I couldn't hold my shit together. And I just thought that's what weed was until next time I smoked weed. Then they're like, you know, no, that was
Your tolerance
PCP.
Was super low, and then like when we were smoking it all the time, our tolerance was getting higher. And also, when I say all this, I was a bad drug dealer. I mean, I was not, it was not.
Oh, you made it sound good.
It was
you said like you were good at it.
Yeah. I mean, I made probably less money than everyone else. Like, we'd go out and, because I like to have fun.
Right.
And I was just in this because I had no direction. I just sort of landed here, you know? I just was like, I wanted to have fun and hang out with girls and do drugs and have a good time. So it was like the selling drugs part was just what I had to do to get there.
Yeah.
You know? And to have protection around me and shit like that.
It's so funny how different, because I know a lot of guys who played your character, and they were all very driven by money and hustle. The hustle itself was addicting, and I like how you're just like, yeah, but this was where the girls were.
Right, yeah, but I pretended like I cared about the hustle.
Yeah.
But that's only because the community I was in cared about the hustle.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to.
And then you were just already kind of a driven entrepreneur type.
Yeah, so I was just like, yeah, the hustle. Yeah, we're going to make all this money. But like, I would like leave money on the table to go with the girl at any. I would leave the rave early. You know what I'm saying?
Like,
so other people were the money over anything. You know, I wasn't like that. I wanted to have fun. And I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, so we started doing that. That, and then we also did a thing called scores. Have you ever heard? Let's do a score,
like hitting a lick.
I think so. So that's like where you get a big bunch of money in one shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whether it's like, oh, I'm selling 100 fake hits to ecstasy, or I'm gonna strong arm rob these people, or something like that. So then, like, we'd go to raves and sell drugs, and then while we were in Brooklyn, we'd set up scores, as many scores as we could set up, and that's, like, this life that I was living.
You're so lucky you're alive.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you're beating...
Ravers,
you're fine, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was mostly we were robbing kids who were fucking rich from Connecticut.
Yeah,
from,
no, fuck
yeah,
most
Maryland.
Of those kids, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't want to hurt them, and I'm sort of sorry.
Yeah.
You know, but at the end of the day, they didn't do drugs that night, so what, are their parents like me?
Yeah.
Right? You know?
It's kind of the perfect crime. I mean, I would have been frustrated, but I was smart when I went through my ecstasy phase. I dated the biggest ecstasy dealer in
the
city, so that I just had a freezer bag to pull.
Yeah.
I can't believe, because I was also doing ecstasy in the 90s and the early aughts, and these days, these kids, they're like on Reddit and talking about the chemistry of it.
Yeah.
And they carry test kits. I was just talking about the test kits on a different episode. Yeah. But they also, they're like, yeah, you can only do it like twice a year or three times a year because your serotonin has to build up and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
We didn't know any of that shit. Yeah. We were so saturated with fucking ecstasy. Like, we were just eating them. You could, like, push on between my shoulder blades and I would get a little bit high because I was just, my body was just storing it because it was so saturated. I'm lucky that I make serotonin.
Yeah. Well, that's good though. That's an example of whatever they're doing is a healthy way to do drugs, because I think there's a place for ecstasy.
Yeah.
And I think there's a place for ketamine. There's proven to be a place for marijuana, you know?
What do you think about the ketamine that they're doing now in the... You can go see a therapist, and they... I know people that are doing these treatments, and they say that they are really helping them.
Yeah. I'm sure it does really help. And but I think the way it works, and someone, if you listen to this and I'm wrong, hit me up and tell me I'm wrong, but it's like a smaller amount that they give you intravenous, and you're still awake enough to talk, because they give you enough ketamine to knock down the walls you put up.
Yeah.
And then you have to talk to a therapist. So it's a real therapy session. That sounds like work to me. That doesn't sound like fun, but I think that would work. I'm probably so scared to do that because I know that that's like what would work. You know, it's like scary to like fix yourself. You know what I mean? So it scares me to like have all my guards down and then talk to a therapist.
Yeah. The only time I've used Molly in the last 20 years has been I used it to work through some shit with someone who we had created so many walls and shit that we had to like use the ego release to get a healthy conversation going. And I think how it was originally made for that is originally made for couples counseling, or now they're using it for couples counseling. I should probably Google some shit before talking on this podcast, but I think it's a great use for that.
Yeah.
I think it's perfect for that. That is not what we were doing with it in. It was this weird cycle, the rave kids, though, right? Because we were all around each other all the time. We were all, it becomes kind of incestuous when you have a social circle like that. Yep. Everyone's stealing each other's girls, like this. And then, but then we'd all do MDMA and we'd all bond at night and care about each other again. And then by the end of the after hours party, we're all fighting again. I definitely bonded with those people in a way that we're friends forever in a kind of weird family of, you know, people I barely talk to on Facebook.
Yeah. The one thing I regret is that I was in the rave scene, but I was through the lens of the tough guy side. Like, I was part of the rave gang. So anyone who was like plur or like throwing the raves, they hated us.
Oh shit.
Yeah, cuz we were fucking it up for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't know that. Like, it's hard to see it when you're young and then when you're in the middle of it, you know? But as I look back, I was like, I would have enjoyed that time of my life more if I could let go of that tough guy bullshit.
Yeah.
And just have a good time, you know?
It's
poison. It really is poison.
Yeah, in Portland, where I was raving, the plur group was still the one selling the, you know, we didn't really have tough guys. We didn't have tough guys in Portland. But I think the rave scene, like, comes up and dies, like, generations. You can't stay in that scene for very long.
Right.
You always got the one old person.
Yeah.
I went to a dubstep show the other night. And just danced my ass off.
Fuck
and I
yeah.
loved it. But then I was like, oh, I'm the old person. I took a long time off, but I loved it, man. I loved my time scene. Do you still love that music?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I put it on sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like once you have a place in your heart for that, or once you've experienced it on those drugs, it kind of stays with you forever. All right, so you're still in Brooklyn at this point. You're in a rave gang.
Yeah, yes. And but I always kept one step out. I kept one foot out at all times, you know? And at one point it was getting really... really bad, where it was like my plans for my future were get some bullshit day job and then sell drugs with the gang at night, and then I can afford everything I need in my life, and that's what I'll do forever.
Yeah.
And right around when I was thinking that, like, my boy Sean got arrested and he was facing some time, so he was trying to get out of it by going into the military. And he was like a really close friend. He was sleeping in my house at my mother's house. And I was like, yeah, I'll go in the military too. And so we started, we were going to go into the Marines. And my grandfather was in the Air Force. So he heard that and he's like, yo, don't do that, asshole. You have a brain. Stupid people go in the Marines. You go in the Air Force. That's where smart people go. So I was like, all right, I'll go in the Air Force. So I started the process to get into the Air Force Reserves because it was like not a full commitment, part-time, go away for a few years for training and then come back, maybe go to college or something. And my buddy Sean was trying to go in the Marines, but he couldn't get in. He couldn't, like, pass the background tests and shit. And so he ended up having to do time for whatever case it was. So
oh,
he was
shit.
Not a long time, but he ended up going to jail for a little while. And I went into the Air Force Reserves. And then I, like, had that first time where I broke it up with, like, a year sober. So I just went in the military, and it was basic training, then tech school, no drugs, no alcohol for a long time. So I was, like, off drugs for, like, almost 2 years. I was off alcohol for a year, and then you slowly get privileges back as you're there for a while, and then as soon as I could get off base, I started drinking, hanging out with girls.
I thought they drank all through basic training at night and stuff.
No,
they don't,
not at all. It's real strict.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it's like they really break you down and build you back up. So doing that, it was the first time I had put in my life a period of sober time, and this is what saved me. It's what separated me and saved me from everyone else, because now I had a year, almost 2 years of improvement.
Right.
And everyone when I was with kept the downward slope. They kept doing scores and selling drugs, and then, you know, you can't beat everyone more than once. So the customers start to dry up. You can't sell fake drugs anymore. What's the next hustle? Then it was like the one girl who was like selling real drugs to BTS. She was making a lot of money. She got busted, went to jail for like 5 years. And then, so everyone was going downhill, and I got to go uphill.
Oh, shit. On a fluke, on friend,
yep.
Like, yeah, I'll do that, and then your friend didn't even go.
And I also, like, I attempted to go to college straight out of high school, so I, like, went to Pace University, and I, like, we couldn't afford it. My parents couldn't afford that shit, so it was like one day they were like, you gotta pay your tuition or we can't let you in, and I was like, just unenroll me, and I walked out. Yeah, it was like 3 weeks in. I'd already started taking classes. I'd even taken a test or two. I was always good at school, too. School was, like, easy for me. So I fucking left that, and I was like, oh, next semester I'll go to Staten Island Community College. And then I did, started at Staten Island Community College, got tired of taking a bus and stopped going, you know?
Oh, my God. And this is before the military.
Before the military, yeah.
So then you get out of the military, you go to college.
Yeah, but that's how I always had one foot in. Because I was always like thinking, oh, I'll try college, or I'll try this. You know, I'm failing at it because of drugs. Then the military, it's hard to fail at it because it's all encompassing. And then I came back to New York, and I was on the reserve thing where I was civilian most of the year.
Did your friends all get hooked on more powerful drugs?
Not like my, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, some did. The friends who did are dead. You know, they overdosed on heroin, and the friend and, like, you know, one really close friend became a construction worker, hurt his back. Now he's hooked on OxyContin.
Yep.
And, like, I talked to him. I hadn't talked to him for 3 years, and I talked to him recently, and he was living in Philly. And I was like, yo, I'm probably going to be touring in Philly soon. I'll come. I'll fucking crash your place. We'll catch up. Like, we were really best friends. And then I hit him up like, hey, I'm about to book some shows in Philly. What's up? Phone don't work anymore.
Oh, shit.
You know? So that's how he disappeared 3 years ago. So he disappeared 3 years ago, reappeared, owning a house in Philly, and then now he's disappeared again. So I don't know when I'll talk to him again.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so, yeah.
I'm oh, my God-ing the home ownership.
Well, like, what he did.
What lick was that?
What he did is he got a settlement because he hurt his back on the job.
Oh.
Yeah.
I would take... There's no settlement I would take to get hooked on oxys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't have to get hooked on oxys.
Yeah.
That had nothing to do with the court case.
You get monthly installments, or we'll give you just one big chunk, but you have to take these.
Yeah. So that's how he ended up. He was like destined to make something like that happen because he went and got this union gig doing construction, and then he bought a condo and flipped it, just the alcoholic the whole time, you know, like,
yeah.
Some people can function, you know.
Yeah.
Some people are good at money too.
Yep.
No matter, some people just luck into money, no matter, like, and they keep flipping their money and they're just good at it. I'm not one of those people.
Yeah. I had a boyfriend who I think he was addicted more to the hustle than anything else, but it was exhausting to tweak with him because it's like, I'm high, I want to make a friendship bracelet right now. I don't want, you had to like go and he would just flip money all day. And we just start out at the beginning of the day with $100. And by the end of the day, it's $5,000, but it's work. It's like, fucking go get a job. God damn.
But that's just like what he liked to do when he was tweaking.
Yeah, that was his tweak. And I was like, fucking drop me off somewhere.
So then I come back from the military and now I don't have to sell drugs because like I go straight into college. And the reason I went into college is because they have the GI Bill, right? So if I went and started school, they'd send me money every month, right? So I went and enrolled in college. I started getting like, it was like $1,500 a month from the military because I was—
On top of college?
Just straight money.
Oh, shit.
Do what you want with it. But if you're in classes, this is your money. So that was coming in. Also, I was on unemployment. Because they count all this 2 years that I did in the military as you know, they have a deal. They're good to veterans. They're good to military people. So now I'm on extended unemployment because I'm going to school. So now I'm on unemployment until I get an associate's degree. And I'm getting $1,500 a month from the military until I get an associate's degree.
Damn.
So I don't have to sell drugs anymore. So now I go get an apartment and I just have to go to classes and 1 weekend a month. But so I'm still kind of like, that's when I really zeroed in and now I'm like just doing ketamine because fuck, I really hope this doesn't get me in trouble one day. I think it's past the statute of limitations.
It is.
But ketamine,
I'm fully educated on the cross section between podcasts and
and statutes.
I've had some close calls.
Yeah. So ketamine you can't test for in urine. Or if you can, it's like so expensive. You have to do some blacklight special tests. Now, this is just drug addict stories that I'm telling.
Yeah.
But it's true. That because I've been tested and not popped. So I'm like, I could do ketamine and drink alcohol and never pop a military drug test. Now I'm going to college because that's what's paying my bills. So it's like I set up this shady way of doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, I found how to get all my bills paid without having a job. I just have to go to school and improve myself.
Yeah, everyone else is going into crippling debt to go to school while having to work at the same time.
I did go into crippling debt after that. But but so I was in, and so I'm going to the City College in New York in downtown Brooklyn. And it was like, I'm like the only white kid in most of my classes, metal detectors at the door. And like everyone else had come from public schools. And I'm not dissing any races. I'm just dissing public schools when I say it was they were poorly educated. I went to Catholic school my whole life, right? So I'm in there and like I would go into the bathroom in City Tech and I would fucking shoot up ketamine into my arm.
Oh, shit.
And I would wander the halls high on K. And I would sit down just as I'm getting sober enough to communicate. I would time it so I'm getting to class at that point. And I'd sit in class just half high on ketamine. And then people would be like, psst, psst, did you do the homework? And then I'd be giving out the homework. So like there was like 2 years of people copying my homework while I'm high on ketamine. That's how bad the public school system is.
Oh,
they were
God.
Cheating off a drug addict. And why did I do my homework? I don't fucking know. I just had to do the homework.
I admired people like you. School was such an absolute grind for me.
Yeah.
And people like you who could just be high and just do the work.
And it was also like I was doing the homework so no one would pay attention to me. Right? Because I want to be high all the time.
Yeah.
So if I always have my homework done, no spotlight. So I'm just like, boom, under the radar all the way through. I did that my fucking first third of my life. I lived under the radar that way.
Why do you think you were getting high?
Oh, man, I got problems. Yeah. I was like, well, it just starts like I was introverted, like very, very, very introverted.
Yeah.
I just wanted to stay home and read. I was leaning heavy towards being a nerd, you know, like I was really nerdy and I wasn't good with people making friends. And so I'm the oldest of my brothers, right? I'm the oldest brother. So I didn't have anyone above me to sort of like groom me. So it was just like, social situations were the grind for me. I was always getting picked on. I wasn't good at talking to girls. I didn't know how to be cool. I didn't know how to be, right?
Yeah.
And so I would get picked on and made fun of, and I'd start fighting. So that was just my cycle, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like they wouldn't just let me be a nerd. They wanted me to fight them. So I'd fight them because it was like I'm not a little nerd. I'm a big nerd, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Let's do this, you know? And it was super weird. And I remember being a kid and not being able to figure out, like, when we're in gym class, I'm better at sports than everybody, but I still get made fun of. But when I watch TV and movies, the kids who are good at sports are popular. What am I doing wrong? Like, that's how my brain was thinking. And so, like, so much of my childhood was, like, trying to just be accepted. Like, can I just please be accepted? Can I please be popular? Can I please be cool, you know? And so I remember the first time I smoked weed, took a drink, smoked a cigarette, was because I wanted to hang out with those people. And I wanted to fly under the radar and just be normal. And so that's what was normal in that situation.
Do you think if you could have found a way to just keep to yourself in it without right, getting picked on or whatever, you would have been okay? There was a desire to be like...
No, there was a desire. There was a desire to be social. Yeah. Like, but I wasn't good at it because I was super introverted. And then I didn't have options, you know? And my parents just didn't know they were supposed to give me options. They were giving me better options than what they had.
But it was... being popular was so fucking important when we were young.
Yeah.
And it... Parents didn't give a fuck about it. It was something that parents found to be ridiculous. When now I think we know how we interact with other people. I mean, I'm glad I wasn't. Nobody liked me. Nobody liked me until I was an adult, and I learned how to change that as an adult. And I'm really glad I didn't peak in high school because I think it does something to you. Too good at high school.
I still haven't peaked. It's coming.
Yeah, same. I'm waiting. But so by the time you're shooting ketamine and going to school, are you still doing it for social reasons
I've crossed the line.
Yeah.
Right? So it's to be popular, but now it's I want to be high all the time.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to be popular.
Yeah.
If I'm high all the time, I have to do nothing else.
Yeah.
Right? And then, like I said, I set up this life so the money kept coming as long as I kept doing the homework and as if I kept showing up and they couldn't pop me on a drug test. So I was like, I did it. I'm the best drug addict of all time.
Yeah.
You know? And I just did that, and then I just got higher and higher and higher. Didn't get good at talking to people. Didn't get good at anything that an adult. I didn't develop emotionally. Like I didn't develop emotionally from 15 to like 23. I was the same emotionally, same idiot, toxically masculine, fight before talk. Also, at the same time, scared of everyone, and that's why I'm fighting.
Yep.
Like just this emotional wreck. Didn't improve at all. And I'm doing that, and then I'm going to school, and then they knock down the fucking towers, so now I have to get activated and go full time.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So then I drop out because they're good to military people, they let me out in the middle of the time. I got activated, right? They have ways for that, whatever, it's allowed. So I leave school, and I go to Bulgaria. And so I'm in the Air Force, so I'm fixing airplanes, and so I'm not getting shot at, which is like, yo, shout out Grandpa, stop me from going into the fucking Marines.
Yeah.
You know, I could be fucking dead right now if I went into the Marines. And so I'm fixing airplanes. I do that in Bulgaria. Now that's another period of time where I found a way to put sober into my life, right? Because I'm not doing drugs. And there was a little drinking, but not a lot. They managed the alcohol we could drink.
Do you feel like you're growing during this time, like emotionally, or you're still...
No. I just got my head down, like, I'm going to get through this time and get back to the good life,
okay.
Right? And plus, this is like, all right, so now I'm activated. I'm serving in a fucking war effort. And so now I'm going to be a veteran when this is over. Because before, I was just in the military, not a veteran. So now I'm doing this, and I'm like, oh, I'm the best drug addict on the planet. Because when I get back from this, I'm not even getting shot. But when I get back, I'm going to be a veteran, and I could go to a VA hospital for life. I'm going to have healthcare for life. I'm going to have this. I'm going to have that because I'm a veteran now. I'm the best drug addict on the planet. and so I do that. So then I insert now, you know, another chunk of time where I'm sober. And then that winds down. I think I was like a year I was activated. It was like 3 months in Bulgaria and the rest of the time working the base in Jersey because everyone – that worked that base was activated out in the desert. So then the reserves came in and worked the base at home while they were gone. And then went back to school when that was over and got real close to getting the associate's degree. And I was like one credit shy. And some teacher walked in and was like, hey, I was doing graphic communication because I was a graffiti writer the whole time.
Right.
And I thought, hey, this has graphic in the title, so let me do this. I put no other thought into it. No other thought. I picked my major on a computer application. Because it had graph, and that was close to graffiti. And so I'm doing graphic communication, and the teacher, the head of the program, comes in, and he's like, yo, if you got decent grades, when you get your associate's degree, you should go to this school in California. And so I apply to the school. It's Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and I got in because, you know, it's a city school. It was easy to get good grades. I had great grades. And I got into that school first try. Plus, I think at that time I was diversity, like, and not anymore, but like I was probably one of the only people from inner city New York applying to this place, right?
Right.
And I was the only New Yorker I ever met there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
On campus, because I got in, I went, but I went before I got the associate's degree. So I was
just
like,
just because the guy was like, you should do this.
Yeah. And I went home that night and applied. And so, but the military taught me this thing that I didn't know, and it was like, if you take action, you get results. And so it's a thing that you do in your everyday life. You say, I'm a park here, I'm not going to pay the meter, the results are I get a ticket, right? But when it comes to like improving yourself, I needed it spelled out for me, and the military did that.
Yeah.
Where it was like, if you take a positive action, you're going to get a positive result, you know? And it also taught me, you don't know what the result's going to be, so you can expect anything. So that night I just went home, I was like, I'm going to take a positive action, what's up? And I got a positive result, and I just bounced. And then I went to Cali, and I went to San Luis Obispo to go to Cal Poly, and then now I insert another stretch of sober time into my life. And so this is these little stretches that I put in are what kept me out of the totally going downhill.
Yeah. And why? Were you sober or not? You just didn't have a hook?
I was only doing ketamine at that point because I'm still in the military, and there's no ketamine. I mean, where's the ketamine at? Yo, if you know where the ketamine's at, hit me up. You know what I'm saying? BrooklynRob.com. But it's nowhere. It's nowhere. I'm the worst guest you've ever had.
This is perfect.
So BrooklynRob.com. The email's on there. So I can't get ketamine. So now I insert long stretch of sober time. I'm going to school again. But now this is where it's like, oh, my God, I am an idiot. Because now I've now gone to the next level where it's only smart people around. So it was like everyone was richer than me. Everyone was more successful than me. Everyone was smarter than me. And everyone was like emotionally further along than me too. I was the only idiot who would get into a fight, you know? So now
shit.
I was like, oh, so now I'm in another situation where, oh shit, I'm not popular again.
You know?
So I started to adjust. I started to figure it out, you know? And that's when I started to grow as a person through a lot of embarrassment.
Yeah.
A lot of embarrassment. Because when you realize that that people can handle life better than you, like emotionally, you know, it's like you feel like an idiot.
Yeah.
And I sound like an idiot. I would like raise my hand and curse in class. That's how much of like a stoop kid I was. How much of just inner city stoop kid I was. I'm like, yo, check it. So this fucking printing press, right? Like, like if I fucking put the blue ink up in this shit, and no one ever said anything, but their eyes would widen and they just stare at me, and like no one wanted to say anything because I guess they realized that I was the diversity they were looking for. And so then I was still writing graffiti. I found I found the only other dude writing graffiti out there. We started writing graffiti together. He was from fucking Compton, a black dude from Compton who was also running from his life, and I was running from my life, so it worked out.
Is there a high with that?
Oh, yeah, because you're doing something illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're in an area you're not supposed to be, and you got to be quiet. You feel like you're like a ninja or like a fucking special operations guy where you're sneaking around with a goal. You know,
yeah.
The goal is to write my name on this thing, and here's how we're going to achieve the mission. Yeah, there's definitely that to it.
I've been thinking a lot about all of the places, all of the things I am addicted to still, and all of the places where I'm just getting that little hit of dopamine or
right.
You know, or
yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And then realizing a lot of things that people are into, like people have just found sometimes healthier with jumping out of airplanes or whatever, for the high.
Right.
But then when you were just talking about graffiti, I'm like, what is the Oh, yeah.
And then it's also the art that you could do and still be tough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then so I'm in San Luis Obispo and like I'm break up with a girlfriend and I'm kind of hitting a low point while I'm out there, and I had seen an improv show with this girl that I was dating, and I watched the improv show and I was like, you know what, I could do this. And she's like, no, only your mom thinks you're funny, right? And so that's in the back of my head. So during the breakup I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna go try out for this improv team, and I get on the improv team.
Oh shit.
Yeah. And then I'm pretty good at improv, like right off the bat I'm one of the better people on the team. And I think it's just because, you know, like New York has a culture of like sort of like we roast each other. You gotta be quick-witted.
You say
something stupid, someone's gonna get on you for it. So you have to be quick. And then also selling drugs, you gotta be quick. You gotta outsmarting police. You're outsmarting people who are trying to rob you. So all that shit. And now all of a sudden, I'm good at improv somehow.
Yeah.
Like, improv comedy.
It's quite the life path.
Yeah. So I'm doing improv for a while, and then they would do once a quarter, they'd do stand-up shows, and then I watched the dudes do their stand-up show for the first quarter I was on. I was like, none of these dudes are really funny. You know, like, they're fine. They're telling jokes that are sort of funny, but it's just like, yo, none of these kids are, like, really doing stand-up. So it's like, I'm going to do stand-up. So I have them help me. I'm writing a set and shit, and I do stand-up the next quarter, and I go out. I do 20 minutes my first time for 100 people and just smash, just demolish. And then I'm like, I'm gonna do stand-up.
I love your just way of meandering through a million different life experiences so much. This makes me... I love it because this is kind of how I've lived my life. It's just like, oh, okay, I'm a comedian now.
Yeah.
And now, I'm this. I'm going to be a hypnotist. I saw a hypnotist. It was cool. I'm a hypnotist now.
So do you ever feel like you're not really a comedian? Because I feel that way sometimes because I was never a big comedy fan and I didn't study comedy my whole life and I wasn't on a purposeful route. Now I feel like I still feel like I'm not a comedian. Like I'm just this guy from Brooklyn who's good at stand-up.
Yeah. You know? I felt like comedy is weird in that I don't like it. I don't like being a comedian. I knew I would be famous when I was a kid. I knew that. And I didn't know how, but I like was like, I'm a star. Yeah. And with no like talent, you know? It was just like, I think I can act because I'm full of shit.
You had self-belief.
And then comedy like kept finding me and pulling me in. So the first time I do stand-up, it's because I lied and told people that I do stand-up.
Oh, my God.
I get on stage because I have to because I've lied and I got to. And then this is the 90s. There just like weren't women comics in the area. I was one of two. And I get up, I do the show and crush. And then I get asked to do a comedy competition. And then over the course of 3 weeks, I've done 9 sets. And now I'm a professional comedian because I win this comedy thing.
I won a contest also. That's how I really became a comedian.
And then that's it. And then you're just on the road because then they pass your info around.
That's so funny.
And then I was just a professional comic. And then I quit to do drugs. And then I didn't think I would go back because I'm like, well, I'm not getting up there sober. And then fucking somebody asked me to do a show and I don't really understand what's being said. And I commit to this show. And then... I do it again, and then the guy who sees me doing it is like, I'm taking you on the road, and I'm like, I don't want to do stand-up. And he takes me on the road, and then all the places that I did it, this is on the, like, the recovery circuit, they all asked me to be the headliner. So then I work that circuit the next year for like 2 years. Then I quit. I take years off. I come back again. And I do an average of, I never did open mics or showcases, so I do an average of 5 shows a year. Total, leading up to the year before this is not happening. So I guess I'm not. I'm kind of not. I've definitely done like less than, now I've done a lot more, but even still, I think I'm just a person that tells funny stories. I think I'm still lacking in a lot of, but same thing. Yeah. I didn't, you talk to other people and they know, they've read every comedian's books.
They're like, I watched SNL when I was a kid. Yeah. And I knew that I wanted to be that. I was like, I didn't, bro. I wanted to get high. I wanted to fuck. Like,
yeah. I knew I'd be a star.
And so I had those fantasies too. I don't know if I go as far as
Does everyone have them though? Is what kind of where I ended up.
But like
with
when I was a kid, we'd be listening to music like in the car on the way to the beach and I would imagine myself if I was the singer of that song and how I would perform on stage and the movements I would do and how I would use the mic, that was like a recurring fantasy in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think if you got that in your head already, you're like leaning toward it.
I feel like, though, my biggest asset in comedy is the life experience.
Yeah, me too.
So it's like I learned the other stuff. I learned how to hold my shit together on stage. I learned a lot of that in the last year.
Yeah.
I learned the art of comedy. And
you can
stuff.
Learn the joke structure.
I learned
structure.
All that, but
I'm still learning the joke structure.
Yep.
Like, yep.
But I have all the life experience to draw from, which is worth more.
Yeah, it's the stuff you're putting into the structure.
Yeah.
That counts more than the structure itself.
Yeah. So you are legit, living legit. Now you're a comedy guy.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there's a lot of stuff between college and there, other low points, but less and less drugs as time went on. And
can we tell a story of when your friends came to visit?
Oh, so yeah. So like I would have friends come from New York to San Luis Obispo every once in a while. The most famous story of that is on This Is Not Happening when Gary came to visit and we went to Mexico. And that story that I told was one of like we went like 20 times.
Yeah.
You know?
And then, so now you have figured out where.
Still, it wasn't. I was doing drugs every day. It now became like it became an adventure, which is how normal people do it.
Yeah,
normal people do it once a month or once a quarter or once a year. It's an adventure. They enjoy it and it goes away. So now I started by accident enforcing those habits of a normal drug user, and then I had some friends who were going to go to the Love Parade. They were driving from Mexico, where they picked up their shit, and they were going north to the Love Parade in San Francisco. And I'm like on the halfway point. I'm like, come pick me up in San Luis Obispo. And they do that, and they left the ketamine in San Diego. And so all they had was meth. And so I'm like, well, I'm not going to stay sober.
Those are two different ends of a spectrum.
Yeah, but if I'm sober around these friends in quotations, I hate them.
Yeah,
I have to be high. Yeah. These are drug friends. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't trust these people. Like, I have
history. Had you done meth before?
Like, one of them was an ex girlfriend. Shit. Like, I need to get high. I've done meth a bunch of times, but it was not my thing.
Yeah,
and I go downhill real quick. Real quick. So now I'm doing meth, super strong Mexican meth. We're driving up. We get to San Francisco, and it's just like, I'm high on meth, so I'm already sketched out. And every fucking gangster drug dealer from Brooklyn was at the Love Parade hustling. And I haven't been around these people in a few years at this point. So, like, I'm a little softer than I was then. And now I'm, like, back around all these dreadhead, scar-faced drug dealers from Brooklyn that I used to want to be like, and I don't want to be like them anymore in my real life. And the meth enhances those bad feelings. A lot. So now I'm like, I start convincing myself they picked me up and they took me here to kill me, right? So that's when it goes to psychosis, right?
Yeah.
So now I think they want to kill me. And then all of a sudden I start to see like the shadows, the meth ghosts and shit. I see shadows. I'm bugging out. I think people are chasing me. And this craziness grows and grows and grows until I'm full on sprinting through the streets of San Francisco.
You just start running away from the parade.
I think gangsters from Brooklyn are trying to murder me. In full-on meth psychosis. I'm running through the streets of San Francisco, and I'm like, if I stay on the streets, they're going to catch me, so I have to run along the highway. So now I'm running along. I don't know what highway it was in San Francisco. I'm running along the highway, the side of the highway, full-on sprint. Full-on sprint. I run up like a hill, and now I'm in someone's neighborhood, and I'm running, and I'm climbing through people's backyards over fences, and finally I'm like, on someone's porch in their backyard, in their back porch, next to their sliding glass doors, their beautiful little backyard, their trees, their potted plants all around me, and I'm hiding behind their potted plants. And I call 911. And I say, you gotta help me. There are people trying to kill me. From drug dealers from the Love Parade are trying to kill me. And they've chased me into this backyard, and I'm hiding. I don't know where I am. I'm not from here. Please triangulate my cell phone. And so this is before phones had GPS. So this is, I had a flip phone or whatever. Please. And she's like, we can't do that. You have to tell me where we are. We can't triangulate your flip phone.
Just like saw that on
SVU or something. Yeah. Triangulate my position. And so I was like, all right, well, if you can't find me, I'm gonna have to find a way to find you. And I hang up the phone, right? And I'm like, all right, I gotta figure out a way to find the cop. And then I hear
can you triangulate this rooster?
So then I think what that really is someone had chickens and a rooster in their backyard. Yeah. Lovely little neighborhood in San Francisco. Yeah. And I woke this rooster up and I was pissing it off.
Yeah.
And so it was crowing at me. I thought it was the drug dealers who wanted to kill me saying that I was hiding like a chicken. And I was being chicken. So I pick up a tree. A tree with its pot. And I throw it through the sliding glass doors.
Oh, fuck.
And it's a little old lady that lives in this house. She comes and hears the crash. gets out of bed and comes. I stay on the porch because I don't want to be like in the house or whatever. And as soon as she sees me, I say, call the cops. Call the cops and tell the cops to come here. So then I fucking wait for the cops. Cops come in, guns out. It's dark. I just put my hands up. I get on my knees. I get on the ground, do everything they say. But like in hindsight, that's so dangerous. I could have just been shot dead.
Yeah.
Straight up shot dead. And they take me out front. And they're going through my wallet and they're asking me what happened. And I'm still in a meth psychosis, so I believe that. I say, listen, I'm from Brooklyn. I'm going to school out here. They're going through my wallet. They pull out my military ID. They see my military ID, and I say, I'm going to school out here. I met some old friends from back in Brooklyn. It didn't go well, and they're trying to beat me up.
Yeah. You know?
They're trying to beat me up. And the cops, both of them are fucking military guys, right?
Oh, shit.
So they see I'm in the military, so now all of a sudden I get the special treatment. So they're like, all right, well, what are we going to do? They decide they're not going to arrest me, right? Because I called the cops.
Right.
So I say, check the phone records. Not only did I call from this cell phone here, check that. I called from that cell phone, asked the lady what I told her. They asked the lady, and she was like, he broke my window and said, call the cops. So it's like this weird, I put myself in this weird gray area, right? Because
yeah.
It was like, I was trying to get in touch with the cops, and they were like, all right, well, he's got some leg to stand on here, and he's a military dude. So they're like, what do you want to do about this lady's door?
Do they suspect that you were on meth at all?
Listen, I thought I was getting away with it, but there's no way. They must have known I was high. They must have known, right? But
yeah.
I'm on meth, so I think I'm getting away with it. I think I'm mastermind, you know?
Yeah, PTSD maybe, would they think?
I don't think so. I think they knew I was on drugs and partying. Yeah. But so much of it lined up where it was like, I was in the military. I am from Brooklyn. There is this love parade going on. I am going to school in San Luis Obispo. There's proof for all that is true.
Yeah.
So they probably put the story together like, he came up here and his old friends got him too fucked up and he can't handle it.
Yeah.
And so
you didn't float that rooster thing past them.
didn't mention the rooster. Actually, when they were arresting me, the rooster crowed and I was like, what is that? You hear that? And he was like, it's a rooster. That's a rooster. And that was the first time that I had considered that it might have been a rooster. I was like, oh, okay. Okay. So I put myself in some weird gray area. So my dad was a cop, and I got a lot of cops in my family, and I'm selling drugs. I had a lot of run-ins with cops. So I was really good at putting myself in a gray area.
Yeah.
Or trying to get the cops to feel for me. You know what I'm saying? Like, being a dick to cops, never going to work.
Right.
But being nice the whole time, seeming like you're usually a good guy, and finding a way to put yourself in a gray area, that might work for you. And in this instance, it did, because they're like, all right, how do you want to handle this? I was like, take me to an ATM. I'll take all my money out of ATM. I'll give it to her for a door. Right, so we went and I pulled out. I only had like 130 bucks I could access.
Yeah.
You know, and I gave her the 130 bucks and she's like, that's not going to cover it. And I took her address and I was like, I'll send you the rest of the money. And the cops took me to the bus station and I used my credit card to buy a ticket. I took a bus back down to San Luis Obispo. But then I was in that psychosis still for like the next day and a half.
Oh, shit.
So I didn't do meth. I hadn't done meth for 12 hours and I was still like looking out my window and I was in a dorm, in a college dorm with a dude from Hawaii, right? And he was like, what are you looking at? And I was like, I don't know. Is that a camera out there? Like thinking there was a camera. It took me. It was another day before I fell asleep, and then like it was wild. And then I never sent her the money because I was like too broke to get the money together. You know, I was just a college kid. And then I lost her address. And if I did know who she was, I would pay for the rest of that door. So if she happens to be a drug addict listening to this,
yeah. So if you know where to get ketamine, or you know
who this old lady whose
door
I smashed, please hit me up, brooklynrob.com.
Are you sober now?
For the most part, I'm sober. Yeah, like I don't
soberish.
I use drugs like a normal person.
Yeah,
I was never. If it's possible to do that, I know a lot of people who are in the programs like NA and shit like that. They don't think it's possible. Once a drug addict, always a drug addict. But I just love what I'm doing with like stand up is such a challenge that it keeps me so occupied. I would never want to ruin that with a drug problem. And I also, I'm trying to do screenwriting, which is another huge challenge. And so like, I take what I do very seriously, so I can't be a drug addict.
Yeah.
I found what I was supposed to do. If I had found improv comedy when I was a little nerd, I would be a little bitch and probably a lot fatter right now, but I would have been doing comedy the whole time.
Yeah.
I just took me so long to find the thing. It needs to be the thing that I love. It needs to be very challenging. And so that's what this is. It's very challenging. Yeah.
Do you feel like you fixed the broken pieces?
No, I didn't fix the broken pieces, but I'm at least at a point that I'm aware that I have broken pieces, you know, and that I can't fix them with drugs.
Right.
You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I'm getting to the point where maybe I'll be able to fix the broken pieces, but I'm on the road. I'm halfway down the road toward that.
I like that. I like that. I think a big part of recovery working is finding your thing. And I do think some people can never use at all.
Yeah.
But it has to be about something. Like it has to, something has to matter. It has to be about something. And then also knowing, I love how you put that. Like you still have the broken pieces, but you know, you can't fix them with drugs.
Yeah.
You can't run from them with drugs.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of can,
loop. If my behavior is a certain way, I can identify that I'm behaving this way because of the broken pieces.
Right.
Whereas you don't, so that it's almost like my behavior sometimes is a symptom. It's not who I actually am.
Right.
And if you can control those symptoms, you could be who you actually are.
Yeah.
But and it's on the guy side of it, I had, like I said, so much of that being a tough guy and getting into fights and the toxic masculinity shit, all that is in there too. So it's like, you know, I have to like let go of that stuff. Like to be, I want to be a nice guy who's having a good time and doing comedy and getting along with people.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to be that guy all the time.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
So you stay in a place of personal development and kind of evolution.
Yeah. I mean, I still snap out. I'm not saying I'll never get in another fight. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know?
I like it. Definitely go check out Rob's This Is Not Happening. Where else can people find you?
BrooklynRob.com. Check out my tour dates. I got a bunch of stuff all over the Midwest, all over the West Coast. Probably going to add some East Coast stuff soon. And then the email's there if you got ketamine hookup. And if you know whose window I broke in San Francisco in the Love Parade in 2006, hit me up. I'll pay for the rest of that window.
And on where are you at on social media? Do you have a podcast or you have a video?
I don't have a podcast yet. I'm going to get one because they're more important than TV credits.
Yeah.
But so look out for that. But I'm at Rob Loves Bagels everywhere. And I also have a sketch team that does all sketch based on the world of graffiti called At Three Letter Crew, spelled out.
Nice. All right. Thank you so much for coming. I love this. As always, you can find me, Jessa Reed Comedy, on Twitter and Instagram. Jessa Reed on Facebook, if I haven't left it yet. Soberish Pod at Instagram. Don't go to Soberish Podcast. That's some asses that aren't us.
Copy that.
And as always, make sure you check out Mormon and the Meth Head podcast. Start at the beginning. It's a podcast that I have with Aaron Woodall. If you like childhood trauma, more funny drug stuff, we had Rob on there at one point. And we'll see you next week.
Peace.